Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan and Jorgen.
Hello, fellas.
The Not a Thing podcast, up and running for episode 222. Is that an auspicious
number? Nice round number.
Yeah, we should have done something with the number. I don't know what we would have done.
Drawn a cool logo or something.
I don't know. I think we've allocated our logo budget, 4 years ago, and I think that it's now out.
Not a recurring post.
No. Unfortunately not. We have to, we should have invested that money into Bitcoin, and then maybe we would have been able to get a new logo at this point.
Well, I mean, our logo budget was free.
Yeah.
So I think we'd have just as much money from Bitcoin as if we had invested $0.
Okay, I guess, you know, multiplication works that way, right? Well, Bitcoin has been in kind of the dumps the last few days. Not really bad, but certainly lower than it has been. Certainly off its high, which I think goes to show it's a little crazy still. But then also how hard it's going to be to turn that into like a currency kind of a thing. I think it's still a neat technology, and we've certainly talked about it exhaustively at that point. But yeah, it's not. I don't know. It needs more legitimacy.
Well, it's apparently very stealable because they just had the biggest heist in crypto history. Someone stole $600 million worth of some coin that I'd never heard of.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's not Bitcoin though. That's you know, crypto coins in general, which I think are, you know, they, you know, in order for that to make any kind of sense, it needs to be, if not regulated, at least monitored in some way by groups that are not just random people on the internet. But
are all cryptocurrencies based on blockchain?
Many of them are, but not the same blockchain.
Right, because blockchain is supposed to be like the safest, ultimate thing to conduct all kinds of business on the internet because of how trackable and safe and unhackable it is. And then you hear about these heists, yep. Which is baffling.
Yeah. Oh, we'll probably have to do another update to Bitcoin. Maybe when it makes more sense.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
But speaking of something that doesn't make sense, I did something a week ago that I probably have not done in months upon months, which is commute on in a car in the Bay Area. so a little background on this. Ever since I moved to the Bay Area I moved back to the Bay Area after college in 2000 for work. I always drove to work, always, which is weird because before I went to college, when I would work, I was working in San Francisco, but I was living in Daly City, so I was able to take like buses and BART. When I was in high school, I would do buses all the time. And so it really wasn't until after college that I had to drive for work, and I put so many, many hours in cars on different commutes. I was commuting out to Fremont, which is, you know, a good 50 miles from here. Thankfully, I never commuted to San Francisco kind of regularly. Although when I would do that, I would also try and take Caltrain. So it was an anomaly this week. My work had shifted last year, as we talked about, and I travel for work. So I'm almost never in the Bay Area during the work week. So I'd be like, I walk to work, or maybe I would take a Lyft, maybe, but primarily it's been a very, commute free kind of thing, at least on a daily basis. And then all of that got upended because the client that I was working at was in Mountain View, which is reasonably close by. It's 12 miles away, and yet it took almost an hour to get there.
Wow.
I think maybe it's not 12. I think that number might be wrong. It might be 22. In any case, much, much longer than it needed to be for the distance that I was traveling. Yeah.
I'm no mathematician, but I think that would put your average speed to about 22 miles per hour.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Right.
That is slow.
Yeah. So, and it's very humbling.
Yes.
At least after the initial kind of road rage kind of wears off. It's that, what is it? It's denial and anger and then
Yes.
depression, bargaining, and then acceptance, right? So
But
yeah.
I think this kind of this like commute is different to different people. I for a while I live an hour north of San Francisco, an hour and 15 minutes, and for a while I worked for a company based in Redwood City, which is about a 2 hour drive, and I only had to do that drive twice a week. Because I would spend the night down there and I would work 2 days a week. But when you drive from up here, you have to get up at 5 and leave at 5:15 to beat the traffic onto the Golden Gate.
Yeah.
Because as long as you like get past Novato and everything before things tighten up, then you're good. So I would sometimes have an hour. I would get up at 5, leave at 5:30, get to the Golden Gate at 6:15, and then drive up in the Marin Headlands and have a cup of coffee in the newspaper to the sunrise, which is a beautiful way to spend your morning, before I kept driving down. And with tons of podcasts and audiobooks and everything, I didn't mind it that much, actually.
But I think that's I mean, the distance you were traveling was a little more reasonable time-wise,
Yeah.
right? Because you were
Yeah.
probably going like 70-ish miles in 2 hours, say.
Yep.
So
Yeah, it's
that's,
exactly 70 miles.
yeah, so that's that average and that math is a little harder, but that's like 35 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, I mean, when,
That's the slowness that kills you.
yeah. I mean, when I had a few moments of, because there's stretches of it where it's quick and stretches of it where it's slow, right? Because that's the average. But when it's slow, it's like I could be on a bike and flying through here, or some other mode of transportation, and it's usually not, or at least on the days that I drove back and forth, I didn't see a single accident. So it's just the crush of humanity and everyone, going in that direction at that time that is that's causing it to be slow. Which I know that because I would remember how I would commute, because that it was this was roughly my commute when I had moved into the Bay Area. I was going from Sunnyvale to Mountain View along 85, which it's a relatively new freeway in the South Bay, and I remember when they were building it, when I was going to college, and thinking, oh, that's a good idea. That'll probably, add a lot more commute options to the Bay Area. And then when I started actually using it, it was just slammed on the first day that it was open, essentially. There were that many people that were, wanting to take that route to work rather than whatever the surface street was at the time. So, yeah, it's
Too
not
many
a.
people.
No, go ahead.
There's just too many people.
Yeah.
Quite simply, too many people.
I wouldn't mind it, had it been like a, if it's. Because I've certainly worked at places that had work from home kind of capabilities, but I mean, my current job is not one that I can work from home at, really, unfortunately. There's just some jobs that require you to be in the office, and in this case, it because I essentially am teaching in a classroom. There is distance learning, but I'm not a fan of it. I've done it, and I think. There are just some jobs you do have to be in for, so I can understand that. I find it so. The thing that gets me for the commute is that as individual as everyone kind of is in their own car, it would be. I understand, if we all took a bus, it would be less cars on the road, things like that. I'm not sure if we can get away from cars in that kind of way, because I think there is kind of a. I mean, there is that sense of individuality, but it really doesn't work. Because it's like, yes, you're individual, you're in your own car, you can have your own music and everything else, but it really is a, like, we're all going in the same direction and we're all locked into these lanes, so don't be a dick and, like, weave in and out of lanes and otherwise mess traffic up.
But won't automated cars help solve that problem in that they'll increase the efficiency of the commuter?
I would think you would think so, but everything that I've read for that is that it's still not a collective of cars that will be automated. It's every car for themselves, so they can only see the car in front of them, which I think has the same problem. I mean, the main thing that I notice for traffic slowdown is that if someone taps their brakes, that kind of slowly echoes back along the line, and as reaction times kind of work, they don't, you never anticipate the break. So what happens is everyone kind of reacts later, so that slowdown just kind of trickles backwards and gets longer over time. That's why it seems like when one person steps on the brake, like if you're 10 cars behind them, you're stopping for a lot longer than they did, even if all they did was, like, you know, tap their brakes. And I used to think that that was, like, sort of a myth until you're on a, if you're on a hill at all and you can see very, very far ahead of you, you can actually see that happening. You see the brake lights trickle all the way back to you. And it's so frustrating because you're right. If computers could see that, they would A, smooth that out a lot more, and B, if like the car 10 ahead of you could tell that to all of the cars behind it up to you, it would smooth that out. But I think the current technology is still, what is it? I forget what the National Highway Transit and Safety Administration's, like, levels were, but I think that's like level 5 driving auto driving, when all the cars talk to each other.
Yeah.
Like, the current target right now is level 4, where at least the car knows about the car in front of it and the one behind it. But it's still like, you know, it's taking an individualized commute and kind of understanding that it is a kind of collective kind of action, and that's the thing that I think would smooth that out. And you can do that in, you know, as a person, but you have to be paying attention. And I think there are enough people that aren't paying attention on the road that it becomes difficult.
How do you guys feel about taking detours that take you off of a jammed freeway that will take you longer in time, but mentally feel faster?
I will do that if only to get out of the commute frustration, but I fully acknowledge that almost none of the time is it faster.
Oh no! It is definitely measurably slower from a time. Like, say you have the Novato Narrows, which is a very local example.
Yes.
Getting through that, you can do it in a certain period of time. Mm-hmm. However, there is a detour you can take, which I'm not going to say what it is because I don't want people to know, that takes approximately 20 minutes longer, but there is zero traffic and it's scenic, and it feels faster because you're actually driving rather than going in stop and go.
Yeah.
Do you think that's worth it? Because if time is the only commodity we really have, you're losing time in time units, but your quality of time is better.
Yeah. Well, there's a trade-off.
It's higher quality, but lower quantity.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a trade-off point where that makes sense. I know that in my commute, you know, like to where it was, I was thinking of all the different routes I could take, and like I could take like 9, or I could take Central Expressway, or I could take El Camino at one point. You know, there's lots of different options, all of which are slower. But there are a couple that are smoother, and it is that kind of, you want the appearance at least that I'm using this car at the correct potential. Because at some points it's like, oh, or I could be on a bike, or something. And I wish that there were a more or a less stressful option, because that's really what it comes down to. It's not so much a time-based thing. Like when I was talking about if I was commuting to San Francisco, I would take Caltrain, which does take a long amount of time, especially if I don't catch one of the bullet trains. But if I do that, I'm not driving any of the time that I'm, you know, commuting, right? I'm not driving for the 45 minutes that it takes up to San Francisco. I have to walk to, you know, one bus, and that's not, you know, and then the bus, I just, as long as I can get on the bus, it's fine. Even if I can't sit down, it's still like I'm not driving. I'm not thinking about that. I can just have some music in or podcast or whatever. And it does make the overall kind of feeling of it better, even if it's not faster. And I think you're right. It is the trade-off is amount of time and quality of life. And it's a pretty good that's a very reasonable choice when you can make it, in my opinion. I think that does make sense in the majority of cases. I will usually tough it out if I'm on the way to the office, but then I will take the more scenic route on the way home.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But in any case, commuting, not a thing. Not for a little while, at least until we figure out how to either get more automation or less people.
I mean, well, with what they're doing over at Boston Dynamics with those killer robots, I mean, we could have both those things.
Well, one can hope. One can hope. But kind of speaking of commuting, you watched a documentary on commuting this week, right, Brendan?
Yeah, it's also not a thing. I went and saw the latest Liam Neeson action flick, The Commuter, which, in fact, is a commute on a train.
Oh.
And with the people I went and saw it with, we decided it was actually Snakes on a Train without the snakes.
Oh, man.
So what I wanted to talk about this week, I saw two movies, one of which was The Commuter, and one of which was Phantom Thread, the newest Paul Thomas Anderson movie. So I really hit both sides of the spectrum here. I've got an absolute steaming pile of garbage, and then I've got a really well-made movie. But the thing is, and this is why I wanted to talk about this, The Commuter is garbage, but a lot happens from a plot perspective. Whereas in Phantom Thread, it's really good, but really nothing happens. Things happen, but it's not... it's a very, very short story. And both of these movies are also done by directors who have worked with their lead actor multiple times. The Commuter was directed by Jean Colette Serra, who's done four movies with Liam Neeson, which I think really are all the same movie.
They're all pretty much the same movie over and over again.
One of them was Nonstop, which I think was basically this movie on a plane.
Yes.
So, he's done four of those of varying mediocre quality. And then Paul Thomas Anderson, this was his second movie working with Daniel Day-Lewis in his last supposed performance.
After There Will Be Blood.
Yes, After There Will Be Blood, both of which...
favorite movies of all time.
I will say, though, that Liam Neeson's acting, old man hurt face, is pretty strong. Like, he gets his ass kicked in that movie. It's like, that's a guy in his 60s getting his ass kicked. He does it pretty well. Like, it felt like it hurt.
Okay. He's selling those hits. Okay.
Yeah. I would not recommend seeing The Commuter. But Jürgen, you saw Phantom Thread, right?
I did see Phantom Thread.
And what did you think of it?
I mean, your question really goes to the heart of, like, why do you go to see movies? What is the purpose of going to see movies? And it's different for different people, and it's different for me depending on what kind of mood I'm in.
Yes.
I mean, I loved the Dunkirk, for example. I loved the Batman movies. These are things you need to see in the theaters. But I loved seeing The Phantom Thread and to see it in the theater, because that kind of movie making, where it's the photography and the costumes and the light and the sound, and especially in this movie, the sound design is absolutely genius, and it adds to the storytelling in a different sense than what the plot does. So
yes,
I really loved it. I really, really loved it. It was a very, it's like a sensual movie experience where it appeals to a different part of you than a super beautiful action-packed movie does.
No, and I think that speaks to the theater experience as a thing. I mean, we've talked about that, especially when we were talking about Movie Pass and how it's hopefully going to drive more people, you know, to go see things in the theater, because it is a different experience. I mean, no matter how nice your setup is at home, you know, it's different than in a theater, especially and some people, you know, can take this either way or not, but even the collective experience of seeing the movie with other people lends mm-hmm. something to it. I mean, there's some movies that you don't want, like, noise happening in a theater, and then there's some movies where it's like, no, I need that.
Yeah.
Comedy films especially, I think, you know, work really well in that case. I mean, it's really funny, just this last week, I rewatched Get Out with Julie, and it's one of those that I wish I had seen in the theater. That's one that I had not seen. I didn't see in the theater when it had come out, and I really, really wish I had.
I watched it in the theater, and I watched it again at home a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
I did enjoy it more in the theater mm-hmm. with that communal experience.
Yeah.
And coming out of Phantom Thread, I had a great moment where a complete stranger, you know, we're walking out of the theater, and we both looked at each other and had these just confused looks on our faces. We're like, that was weird, right? Like, yes, that was weird. Which it is. It's a beautifully made movie, but it is a tale of bizarre people.
Oh, without a doubt.
And I feel like I spent most of the movie sitting through it like, where is this going? Like, this is all interesting, but what is going to happen? What's happening here? And then it got to the end, and I was just on the edge of my seat with suspense. Like, it really sucks you in.
Interesting.
Yeah. Cool.
Over just mundane things. Like, that's how good the acting is.
Oh, that's neat.
So I think they both took about the same. They're both about 2 hours.
Uh-huh.
Both The Commuter and Phantom Thread. But The Commuter felt like it was 4 hours long.
So it felt like a commute. Okay.
I felt like I was on the commute.
Didn't it?
And spoiler alert, they kill Jonathan Banks.
Oh.
They throw him into a bus.
Oh.
You can't kill Mike Ehrmantraut again.
Well, speaking of movies that take place on trains, I saw the preview for the new Clint Eastwood movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Something to Paris?
Yes, the 5:13 to Paris or something like that, which is about a fairly recent terrorist attack that happened on the 5:13 train to Paris, where three off-duty U.S. soldiers took down this jihadi terrorist who had an AK-47 and was about to kill a lot of people on a train. And one puzzling thing about this movie is that this is so new that it hasn't even gone to court in France. And the other thing that's puzzling about it is that he has the three American soldiers play themselves in the movie.
What?
I heard that.
Yes.
Yeah. I heard that part.
So it's not actors playing the parts of these guys, but they are actually playing themselves in the movie about their experiences before
that's
this
like
thing
is Audie Murphy level shit.
Yes,
this is to hell and back.
Right, and to me, it's like that's very interesting just as a filmmatic experience. And I mean, Clint Eastwood has done this before with the World War II movies, The Flag of My Fathers, and Letters from Iwo Jima. But I was also wondering, like, would this then be able to be used in the court of law as like part of the trial? Like, you guys, not only have they made a movie about the thing, but you act yourself as part of the film. That this means, like, is this your documentary? This is how you really saw it happen. And it's just an interesting point. If the perpetrator now, like, can he change his story and then say, like, well, you guys made a movie about it. This is how you said it happened. And I don't know. It's just an interesting philosophical.
So, something tells me they're not going to give him a chance to make his movie for the.
No, I don't think so.
So I don't. I'm not too concerned that it's going to mess up the court of law. It may mess with the court of historical
public
reference.
Opinion.
Yes.
Does that seem like its own movie where the judge orders that the defendant has to make his own movie?
Yes. I like that.
Fair and balanced. That's how we do things.
Fair and balanced. I also saw Get Out yesterday for the second time, and that movie is excellent.
Oh, how funny that we all saw that in the same time frame. That's so. I think it benefits from being seen at least twice.
Yes.
Because there are so many hints that, like, I that weren't hints on the way in, but now that.
Yep.
Once you've seen it, you watch it again, everything clicks, and it's so good.
Yeah. When they roll in there and, like, the gardener is working on the estate, and Allison Williams says, that's the groundskeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like she says groundskeeper, but then yesterday when I listened, I heard her say the grand keeper.
Oh, interesting.
Keeper of the grandchild. I was like, woo! And there's tons of little, like, peppered little things throughout there.
Yeah.
Lovely, wonderful film. I'm very happy that it's acknowledged by the Academy nominations, even though I'd be surprised if it wins anything. But
I don't think it'll win for Best Picture. I'm not sure what it's actually could win. Because there's some real strong contenders out there.
Yeah.
And this is the first, this is going to be the first year that I can feel fully informed, because I'm only two movies away from seeing all the Best Picture nominees.
Which is and
like
harder.
I'm going to see all the short film nominees.
Are you missing Lady Bird?
No, I saw Lady Bird.
All right.
I liked it. I thought it was very good. But my pick, the only ones I haven't seen are Call Me By Your Name and The Post.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, I saw The Post.
I want to see, I'm going to go see Call Me By Your Name this week. But I'm going to see The Post, but I don't really want to.
It's just to be expected.
Oh.
It's like kind of what you expect Steven Spielberg.
So it's
historical
a
movie
Steven
with
Spielberg liberal circle jerk movie.
Yes, with Tom Hanks.
Aren't we awesome?
And Meryl Streep playing just the stand up for the right thing roles that you expect them to do, and they do a fine job about it. But it, like, having seen it, it's not the kind of movie that I go like, "Ah, my life is better now. I'm so glad I did that." I think I could have just not seen it and would have been just the same person.
Like, the pedigree is almost too good. Like, it feels like, okay, well, we've checked off this box, and we've checked off this box. We got Spielberg, we got Tom Hanks, we got Meryl Streep. How could it not win? Like, I don't...
There aren't, like, real stakes in there. It needs to be a little bit dirty to be interesting, and it isn't. And I think that's the problem with it. It's a little too polished.
Yeah, so I'm going to see it for the sake of being a completionist. But I don't really, I'm not looking forward to it.
You'll get your platinum trophy. Don't worry. It'll just pop up on the screen after you've seen the movie. It's like, achievement unlocked.
I think so far my pick for best picture is still Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Mm. And I, of course, am very upset that Mother was not nominated, but okay.
From what I've heard, America's not ready for that movie, Jorgen.
I don't think anyone is.
That's pretty much what I've heard from most of the people that have seen it.
History will prove us right.
They did an honest trailers for it, and I was like, you know, maybe I'll wait and not watch this. It seems pretty intense.
Yeah, I think I need to be in the right kind of mindset to see it. And I'm not sure what that mindset is, but
the chatter right now, or the odds are favoring either Three Billboards or The Shape of Water is what I hear.
Oh, I got to see The Shape of Water. Yeah,
it's very good.
It's good. I'm not sure it's.
I don't think it's best picture worthy.
Yeah, I feel like it wasn't just. It just wasn't tight enough to really fit in that. But I don't know. From a kind of movie going perspective, I think it was very. It was like you feel good leaving the theater. I guess if that's a barometer for something. Whereas, you know, I watched Three Billboards, and afterwards it was good, but I didn't feel good.
Because it doesn't have a good conclusion. It lacks the final 5 minutes of a proper conclusion. It waters out, teeters out into nothing. I don't like the ending.
Well, we've talked about that one before, so let's not. We can relitigate this when the Oscars actually do come out.
Yes, let's do that. Let's battle it out.
But kind of in the kind of creative vein and how writing is so important and how the kind of movies endure, Jürgen, you wanted to bring up something?
Yes. So there is Lana Del Rey, the top class musician and songwriter, apparently shared last week that she was being sued by Radiohead. Her latest hits, which name eludes me at the moment, was too similar to Radiohead's Creep. And I came across this article and I found it a little puzzling. So I listened to it. And what is similar is the chord progression. I mean, sure. The chord progression of Radiohead's Creep is pretty... pretty well known, and it's pretty unique, and you recognize it right away when you hear it, especially the fourth chord.
It was the third song I learned how to play on ukulele, because it's the same four chords all the way through that song.
Yes, and the chorus, it's the same chord progression. It's the same four chords.
Yeah.
G, D, B, and C. or C and B.
Yeah.
But... the interest. So she was being sued by Radiohead's lawyers, and the reason she went public with this was because she'd been negotiating with them back and forth for a while, and they wanted full song, like all the songwriting incomes from her song, and she had been offering them 40%. So she like has an admission of yes, it's a little similar. But listening to them next to each other, it's just that chord progression, the four chords, and it's not like Radiohead invented the guitar and then used their invented instrument in this way, and she lifted it. It's just like there are only so many chords you can play on a guitar, and chords are the basis for most music today. And I just found it interesting that, yes, that is that chord progression, but her vocal line on top of it is completely different, and the rest of the song and the arrangements and everything else is completely different. So I was puzzled and to how that is the way that it is now. And the plot thickened even more when it turned out that Radiohead actually had to sign over all of their songwriting incomes from Creep to a 70s duo, because when Creep came out, they sued Radiohead and said, you guys stole our chord progression from our song, The Air That I Breathe, in the 70s. So I was like, what? And then I went back and I listened to that one, because Apple Music has everything, and it's the exact same chord progression. And again, in a totally different song and totally different arrangements, although the vocal line on the 70s song is a little closer to the howling that Thom Yorke does over the solo part of Creep. But anyhow, so Radiohead doesn't get songwriting income from Creep because they have to pay it all to the 70s duo. And now they're suing Lana Del Rey for her songwriting credits, and it's all for the same chord progression.
Shouldn't that band from the 70s be suing her to get that?
That's what I was thinking as well. Shouldn't their lawyers be like, ooh, thank you, Radiohead, for alerting us to this? Hey, Lana! this article is really interesting because it also mentions Robin Thicke, who became suddenly very famous everywhere for his hit song with Pharrell Williams years ago. Yes. And he was like, suddenly that was like the biggest hit in the world. And then he was sued by Marvin Gaye's estate because it was too close to, it lifted the bass line and some snapping or something from one of the Marvin Gaye songs. And they were, it's not found guilty in that kind of sense, but the Marvin Gaye estate won that trial, and Robin Thicke had to pay like $5.5 million.
Yeah.
And then the same week his wife left him, and like his whole life fell apart, and no one's heard from him since. But that trial is, and that case and decision is being challenged by a ton of musicians, because they say if that's the standard you're going to rule by, which is what this Lana Del Rey Radiohead thing is also based on, that seriously hinders creativity. You're really limiting creativity and songwriting if you're saying that a chord progression of these four songs, that once someone has done that and recorded that, then that's what it is. And even if you're not, because the way that art is created, you live your life and you look and you listen and you take in all kinds of things, and then you blend it in your own creative mind, and then you create an output of it. And if we're going to be held to such standards that if anything you write cannot sound like anything else that has been done before, you're going to seriously hinder creativity and stop especially musicians from creating. And I've done this myself when I was younger and I was in a band and I was writing music. I wrote a song that we played in the band for a year. We played it live. We went into the studio and recorded it. And it wasn't until a couple of years later I realized that I'd lifted the entire chorus from a Duran Duran song. no one else in the band noticed either. And I had to have like such a distance. I think it was 10 years later. I came across that demo and I listened to it and I was like, oh, this is totally Rio by Duran Duran. I even say the name, the word Rio in the lyrics, and I never connected with it. So as a songwriter and musician, it's so easy to like take things that you hear or notice, and then it's like in your subconscious and becomes part of what you create. And this court decision is just ruining that and upending that. And so it was interesting to see that really big names, songwriters and musicians, are financing a retrial of that case. They're challenging it to be overturned because they find that they think that it's going to threaten their creative process in the future. So that was interesting.
Oh, that is really cool. I think there's certainly been things in the past. I remember seeing a video that was, I think it was a comedian who he's playing guitar, so that's like its own thing. But he in his act, one of the bits that he has is that every song's chord progression, like echoes back to the one in Pachelbel's canon in D.
Yeah, right.
And it's great.
Yeah, there's a couple of those. There's one on YouTube as well, which has, it's like these four chords. I think it's the D, G, A, F. And progression is in like 50 of the most famous songs ever.
Right.
And they just have those chords go, and then they just mix the songs over and out. And it's it's everything from Belinda Carlisle to Celine Dion to Rolling Stones. And
it's I mean,
it says DGAF.
Right. That might be an unintended consequence of that chord progression name, but there's a song by, I think it's Cat Empire, and the refrain in it is how this guy wants to like have kind of a relaxing day, and he needs some 1-4-5, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And he means the chord progression, like a first chord, a fourth chord, and a fifth chord, which is C, F, and G. And yeah, it's like that I'm sure it's a similar progression than the ones we've been talking about in the, you know, I just don't know enough music theory to kind of put these into words that make sense, but there's certainly like similarities in songwriting. I mean, the structure of how a song works, you know, it tells a story, so it has to have kind of a like major keys and minor keys kind of fit together in a particular way. And I think some of that is stylistically similar, and that shouldn't be a bad thing. I think that where it does run into problems is when you're trying to collect royalties on things and understand how music copyrights work and stuff. And I think that is still in kind of a weird state that does not make sense. That aspect of it, you know, I do think creators should be acknowledged and get paid for their creation
of
songs.
Absolutely.
But I think the actual like movement and enforcement of copyright is such a weird and kind of antiquated thing, especially as we move with, there's so many more avenues to create things in and distribute things. You know, with streaming or with video and the ubiquity of everyone having essentially, you know, a production studio in their pocket, you know, having kind of a revisiting of how copyright works and how things like that make sense, and how attribution and what is public domain or creative, and the idea of creative commons. I think all of that is still in flux. I remember, you know, hearing about creative commons as a thing, like the way to do rights management. You know, it's like, hey, this is kind of a new way to think about this it promotes kind of sharing and remixing of things or rebuilding of things. And I think that is a step in the right direction, but I still think that is thought of as a like weird fringy thing that only open source nuts do.
And the way that, especially the way pop music is being written today, where someone comes up with the beat, someone else writes the melody line, and then a third person writes the text, is like, on the latest Beyoncé album, I think she had on average 7 to 8 songwriters on each song. And it's just hard to treat that and the copyright laws in the way that it was designed back when you had like 1 or 2 songwriters per song, or a band was credited to each song. And it's just, I don't know, the whole landscape is changing like that. And the copyright laws, I don't think that they are paying attention and being updated along with it.
Yeah. Well, that should be a thing for sure.
Should definitely be a thing.
I think for music in general, there is a kind of, this is what it sounds like kind of a thing, and it's very easy to pick up on patterns for sound. If you were reading books, it's a little harder, and I think that's That's more difficult. But with songs, like, they tend to be less than 5 minutes long, and it has to have enough that it is catchy. And sometimes that catchiness is that it kind of echoes other songs. I mean, I've certainly heard music where it's like, oh yeah, this sounds like such and such, and it's like, no, that's just a person that sounds like them, and that's why they're popular now.
Yes.
And I don't think that's necessarily bad. And I don't know if it's necessarily like infringement, and it probably isn't. It's just like some people sound the same, and that there's trends to everything, and music is certainly included, you know. And I think it also has, you know, some ability to kind of auto, like, build in an expiration date for this kind of music, because it's like, it's this, you know, 5 years from now, no one will listen to music that sounds like this, except in that kind of nostalgic, oh, remember this? What is it called now? Throwback hits? Is that what the radio stations say? And I think that that's fine. I don't have an issue with that from a listener perspective, but I do think it does need to be worked out from a creator and, you know, creator perspective.
Agreed.
Keen. Well, as creators of this podcast, I think we're wrapping this one up for the cycle. I used to say week, but it's not every week. We record every other week, at least so far. And I think it's working. I think it's been pretty good. If you think it's working also, please tweet at us, Facebook us, let us know on the website, notathingpodcast.com. If you'd like to be a part of our show in any way, shape, or form, you can contribute to a show, or you can even be a guest on our show. We would love it. Just let us know, and we can work that out. And in the meantime, I will see you in a couple weeks.
Until next time.